plenty of this in the world already. What it needs is a way to reach vendors who have no way to listen and instead are grasping at wallets with advertising. Creating the intention economy is one of the jobs we've taken on with VRM, in particular with a new market ritual we call the personal RFP. The term RFP, Request for Proposal, is a standard protocol by which buyers reach sellers in the B2B, business-to-business world. RFPs have been absent in the B2C, business-to-consumer world, for the simple reason that the latter goes only in one direction. The personal RFP will go in the other direction, so customers, no longer mere consumers, can tell the marketplace what they want and get back helpful responses, one of which will result in a sale. For example, you might say, I need a stroller for twins in Ann Arbor in the next 4 hours, without having to surf from site to site looking for sellers who have the product you want, and without having to do all your shopping inside some vendor's silo. Here, real loyalty relationships can be helpful. For example, your RFP might go first to all the vendors with which you have relationships before it addresses the rest of the marketplace. It might also go to new classes of intermediaries, which will emerge because helpful services always show up where there is money ready to be spent. The world today is full of MLOTT, money left on the table. Right now, for example, I'm ready to spend hundreds of dollars on an LED display with a resolution of 1920 by 1200 or better that will work with both a Lenovo laptop and a MacBook Pro, both of which have DVI connections. I've done a bunch of looking on search sites, and I've posted a query on Twitter. Sometimes this works, but not this time. I'm still fishing. I want something better. I want to advertise my intention and have the business come to me. And I don't want to do it inside some website. I want to do it in the open marketplace. And someday I will be able to do that. I know because VRM developers are working on it. The attention economy will not go away. There will still be a need for vendors to promote their offerings. But that promotion will have a new context, the ability of customers to communicate what they need and want, and to maintain or terminate relationships. Thus, the R in CRM will cease to be a euphemism. This will happen when we have standard protocols for all three forms of market activity, transaction, conversation, and relationship. Transaction we already have. Conversation we are only beginning to develop. Email, text messaging, and other standard and open protocols help here, but they are still just early steps. Relationship is the wild frontier. Closed social environments like MySpace and Facebook are good places to experiment with some of what we'll need. But as of today, they're still silos. Think of them as AOL 2.0. And that's not a knock on AOL, which was a pioneer in its day, too. When we finish building the intention economy, the Mona Shaws of the world can approach whole markets with tools of demand that engage and improve the mechanisms of supply. When that happens, the heartless customer service desk will be safe from Mona's hammer because both will be gone. But How Does It Taste? By Rick Levine. I did toy with the idea of doing a cookbook. The recipes were to be the routine ones, how to make dry toast, instant coffee, hearts of lettuce, and brownies. But as an added attraction, at no extra charge, my idea was to put a fried egg on the cover. I think a lot of people who hate literature but love fried eggs would buy it if the price was right. Groucho Marx. You have an oven? Move one of the racks to the middle position, set the heat for 350 degrees Fahrenheit, gas 4, or about 175 Celsius for you folks on the right side of the pond, and turn it on. Take a half a pound of unsalted butter and the same amount of a good dark chocolate, a chocolate you like to eat. Melt the butter and chocolate together in a bowl over some gently simmering water, stirring the mixture a bit. Crack 4 large eggs into another bowl, add a half teaspoon of salt, 2 teaspoons of a nice vanilla extract, and a cup each of dark brown and granulated sugar. Stir the sugar and egg mixture together, and when the chocolate and butter are melted, stir them in too. Fold in a cup of all-purpose flour. Find a 13-by-9-inch metal pan, press a piece of aluminum foil into it, one large enough to hang over the ends, and grease it with a leftover wrapper from the butter. Pour the batter into the pan, put the pan in the oven, and bake for 45 minutes. Scrape the bowl and lick the spatula. When your oven timer dings, take the pan out and let it cool on a rack. If you're really obsessive, you can let it cool overnight, covered in the fridge, but I never seem to muster enough obsession to let it sit that long. Using the foil ends as handles, gently lift the results onto a cutting board, trim off the edges to nibble later, and cut the remainder into 24 brownies. Find a friend or two, a neighbor, your spouse or kids, sit them down in the kitchen and share some brownies. Pour some milk. Enjoy the conversation. A lot has changed in the almost 10 years since we published Clue Train, but there's still a satisfaction I get from baking, from cooking, from talking with people over food. I've come to realize I'm a tactile person. As much as I've used the net, worked in high tech, and depended on technology for a living, I still need to make things with my hands, and still need to hear others' voices. Those needs are the drivers for my current gig, running a small, albeit determinedly clueful, chocolate business. Yes, chocolate. See SethEllisChocolatier.com for the longer story. I find irony in seeing my own career tending toward creating something perceived as completely bereft of high tech, while the integration of the net into the fabric of my daily life continues to increase at a headlong pace. More on that in a bit, but first, to bring the book up to Clue Train 2.0, let's look at some changes. What's different? The biggest changes we've seen since our first pass at Clue Train aren't really in technology. Yes, if you believe the pundits, Web 2.0 is the biggest thing since the internet crawled out from under its rock. But I'm not as sanguine as some about the usefulness of the Web 2.0 label. We technophiles love labels, as they make it faster to classify and understanding what's going on around us. Labeling also lets us dismiss things more easily, as I can discard entire categories in my personal taxonomy when they fall out of favor. The problem with labels is they cut off discourse and truncate the process of understanding and exploration. My answer to a toddler's "What's that?" query shouldn't be, "It's a bird." It's easy to demonstrate superior knowledge by giving names to things, but it's a lot better for kids to be guided with questions. What's it doing? Why do you think it's doing that? Would you like to do that? At least it was better for my kids. They haven't stopped asking questions. Your mileage may vary. Back to Web 2.0. It's not obvious to me if the Web 2.0 label wasn't born out of a premature desire to categorize our social media technology, whether to demonstrate newness, to get some of it funded, or to prove we're observant folks and we know what's going on, preserving some standing in our technology priesthood. Handles like Web 2.0 are mostly useful in hindsight, and often only when the subject being labeled is fairly far back in our rearview mirror. I don't think we're out of the divergent, explorative phase of the development of social media, let alone converging on best practice implementations, to use the label with any accuracy. Almost everything new happening today has seeds in technology existing 10 years ago. The social changes we're seeing are even harder to pin down with labels, as behavioral shifts are often multiple steps removed in time and effect from underlying technology. They come as slow infusions rather than sudden changes in taste. To exacerbate the perils of using our crystal balls in labeling the next big thing, I am, and probably you are if you're reading this, a card-carrying member of the lunatic fringe of early adopters of technology. We're obviously not the primary audience for the toys we build and use, at least not if we're honest about how we're going to make money selling the toys and how they'll be useful to real people. It's more practical to think of social media as the use of the mundane, commonplace technology around us in the pursuit of a goal transcending that technology, fostering conversation and connection between people. Madge the manicurist, speaking for generations of Palmolive users, provided the best guidance for would-be spotters of social media innovation. You're soaking in it. All that said, there have been a few changes since Clue Train. The general outline of change revolves around some basic infrastructure improvements and the resulting social ripples riding along with them. On the short list of change topics are access, data scale, usability, and participation. 1. Access. Data pipes have gotten bigger and faster, and more people are connected to them. 75% of the North American population has access to the internet, and 55% of connected homes have broadband access. In addition, we're less tethered, with 84% of our population having cell phones, as opposed to only 34% in 2000. The U.S. population has also gone from sending 12 million text messages each month when we published the manifesto to more than 75 billion per month now. When we wrote Clue Train, we were very aware of the economic and class-based disparities in access to the net. While those disparities still exist, and I'll get to more on usability, literacy, and age-dependent access below, the increase in access since 1999 is staggering. We were flogging conversation, hoping people would show up, plug in, and start talking. They did. 2. Data scale. More and more information is searchable, and the odds of finding useful answers to my questions on the net have increased dramatically. Even as we're bemoaning how the net may be changing our reading habits and reducing our ability to focus, anyone who can get to the net uses Google, depending on it for everything from quick access to driving directions to being a surrogate memory for phone numbers, names, and facts. 10 years ago, the data wasn't there. There's been a mind-boggling increase in the amount of information available to us on the web since Clutrain. The public web has grown from around 1 billion searchable pages in 2000 to more than 1 trillion today, a 1,000-fold increase. The odds of the long tail yielding information about your products and your company from your customers, one of my favorite Clutrain themes, have increased substantially. Cautionary note. To find data on the net, we depend on people having the foresight and economic resources to keep it on disk, attached to a computer with a net connection. What happens when it isn't feasible for them to continue to maintain their part of the cloud? It's a risk worth thinking about. 3. Usability. On the usability front, we have both good and bad news. Bigger, faster pipes and faster computers are responsible for faster graphics and more responsive interfaces. Similarly, a trend towards smaller applications and reusable chunks of fast, optimized software for our browsers and phones means our interaction with computers has the potential to be faster and less painful. For those of us who are the most computer literate, this is great news. My pages load faster, I can watch video more easily, and the applications I depend on have moved from my desktop to my browser to my phone. The flip side of the usability issue is the continuing lack of support for the less sophisticated in our audience, both seniors and those with only basic literacy skills. The tendency towards complicated, flashy, non-accessible interfaces is exacerbated in part because both the designers and early adopters of much new net technology are young and literate. We're leaving an increasing percentage of our population out in the Web 2.0 cold. The economic aspects of the digital divide get somewhat better as computers get cheaper. The literacy and ageist issues don't. If we're serious about getting as many people as possible under our conversational tent, we need to get serious about designing inclusivity into the web. 4. Participation. In 1999, conversation online was in newsgroups and indexed email lists and captured in web pages maintained by the techno-obsessive among us. Blogging was in its infancy, and a blog was most likely a diary-like page of a website hand-maintained by a very determined writer. Today, thanks to easy-to-use applications and services like Blogger, WordPress, and TypePad, more than 100 million blogs have been started worldwide. Treat that statistic gingerly, as it's hard to tell how many authors continue posting to their blog once the novelty has worn off. Conservatively, there are more than 75,000 blogs with sizable public followings, according to blog search engine Technorati. Google's blog search engine returns results from more than 2 billion blog postings. Considering the number of blogs allowing and encouraging comments by readers, that's a lot of Clutrain fodder. Blogs are one element of the conversational landscape we foresaw when we wrote Clutrain, but social networking on the scale we see today was just a hazy premonition. In hindsight, one of the keys to accelerating the social changes we described in Clutrain has been reducing or eliminating barriers to entry, reducing the friction stopping people from participating in conversations. Many social network apps will, with my permission, harvest contacts from my address book, pre-populating my list of online friends and also letting them know I've arrived, substantially improving the odds of my having someone to talk to. Twitter, notable for legitimizing tiny posts, tweets of 140 characters or less, as net conversation, prompts me to send a tweet each day, dramatically increasing the likelihood I'll participate at least once a day in the network. In addition, many sites use the side effects of my participation to build their shared data space and make it more useful. My purchases on Amazon add to stats showing what people have bought. Flickr feeds show me pictures others are uploading. Delicious, Dig, StumbleUpon, and other social bookmarking sites allow me to search large collections of links highlighted by others, or just see those from my friends or from people with similar interests. Facebook and MySpace widgets let me know what my friends are browsing and listening to. As I recite these examples, it's obvious to me we haven't seen the zenith of conversational tools on the net. The sense of fragmentation in the social media space, of too many options and not enough integration and sharing, reinforces my sense we're still early in the innovation cycle. There are walls between my LinkedIn universe, my Facebook universe, and my phone. Despite attempts to connect my dots of speech, I still perform the same tasks at each service site, gather and regather my set of conversational partners, identify myself over and over again with password after password. We need to be more fanatical in our elimination of conversational friction. I have some hope our understanding of the ground rules for computer-to-computer or service-to-service cooperation is getting sophisticated enough to allow us to begin to piece together the bones of the future semantic web, the shared utility underpinnings needed to allow our tools to do what I mean or do what I need. But it ain't here yet. Looking back at our Clue Train track record, we've seen our prognostications of networked conversation vindicated. While we were optimistic about how quickly the added conversational volume would change the marketing and business landscape, and I leave calibrating that optimism to my fellow authors, there are certainly more people talking, and some may even be listening. Bullshit detection. I'm fascinated by how we distinguish good speech from noise. I still get the occasional email from a friend warning me the sky is falling because of a computer virus and exhorting me to take precautions. While a quick Google search with some text from the message and the word scam can often dispel their fears, I wonder how we train ourselves to trust and not trust, given the paucity of clues about an author's intent and bona fides provided in an email or on a web posting. On one end of the scale are Nigerian 419 and Irish sweepstakes scams. Nobody in my acquaintance still falls for them, I guess because they're blatant enough to trigger skepticism in even the most hopeful scoring-something-for-nothing reader. When I'm shopping for a book, I read reviews and try to discern which of the reviewers are most like me. If I'm considering buying a technical book on chocolate or cooking, do they simply like the recipes or do they evaluate how well they work? Do they state their own background and do so in an open, believable way, or are they self-aggrandizing and therefore seemingly, to me, less trustable? On Amazon, I put more trust in real name reviewers in the perhaps misguided assumption that those willing to write opinions under their own name will be constrained to be more honest. Anonymity may help people speak the truth, but it doesn't help me to trust them. Given a large quantity of prose from one author, whether named or under a pseudonym, we have an easier time calibrating their speech and knowing how to react to what we read from them. As we went through the last presidential campaign and I read through the broadsides about one candidate or the other, I found myself asking, "Can this be real?" and Googled for more info to help judge what I was reading. For instance, a letter from Ann Kilkenny, a voter registrar in Wasilla, Alaska, was published on the net, presenting a critical assessment of Sarah Palin's record from the perspective of someone who knew her and had lived and worked alongside her. A conservative blogger speculated we were seeing the birth of an urban legend and there was no Ann Kilkenny in real life. Later in the day, she recanted, describing her subsequent email conversation with Kilkenny and admitting, perhaps grudgingly, that Ann was real. That open documentation of skepticism and discovery of contradicting truth made her appear more trustable in a way simple protesting speech would not, and gave me a better sense of how to read her other writing. The essence of trust in something I read comes from being able to discern a basic honesty and a sense of openness in the prose. The meme authenticity circulates among marketing wonks when discussing how to create effective corporate blogs, but it's not the same thing. We can tell when a person is writing in his or her own voice. If you're debating whether your corporate speech is authentic or not, you're probably already lost. I'm rarely wrong in deciding if I'm hearing a real person or not. My problem is flipping a coin on whether I trust a stranger to tell the truth, and if they're telling their truth, will it be truth for me as well? As the skeptics among you have pointed out over the last 10 years, our markets are conversations meme has an interesting underbelly. 99.9% of all conversation isn't conversation I want to listen to. That means 99.9% of all markets may be crap too, given that each of us will reject a different 99.9%. But it shouldn't be a surprise, as the wired world reflects the real world. We're awfully selective when we're spending our own nickels. How many of the tens of thousands of products in your neighborhood Safeway, Kroger, ShopRite, or Publix do you actually buy? 99.9% may be a realistic number. Maps, territories, and real conversation. I'm in a real-world business. My product, gorgeous, luscious-tasting organic chocolate truffles, isn't something the internet can help you sample. You can read the reviews, order the candy, and do the electronic commerce dance. But when it comes down to the moment of chocolate truth, you have to be in the same room as the product. After 30-plus years of living with a work product my kids can only see by peering into a computer display, I've realized I like to create things that people can touch. Go figure. Have some chocolate. In the 3 years it's taken us to plan and set up the business, I've had my eyes reopened to how useful and how limiting the net is. On the useful side, the net makes it easy to find possibilities for a business. We search for potential sources of ingredients, for machinery, for manufacturers of various supplies and equipment. But what we receive from a Google search are only possibilities. Almost every purchase transaction is preceded by numerous phone calls, sometimes face-to-face meetings, and lots more legwork than a simple Google search will accomplish. The world reflected in Google is a shadow world, hinting of connections and complexities for our business, but it doesn't gain substance until we have the real conversations leading to an exchange of ideas and goods. Even when it comes to simple documentation, there's an incredible amount of information about the chocolate industry untouched by the net. While the Google folks pride themselves on getting umpteen thousands of Civil War medical records online, I own several shelf yards of reference books from the past 80 years, having, at best, only vague electronic ghosts in Google's online indices. Sometimes the most I can do is find the name of a publisher or author, and then set an automated eBay search for them, hoping sometime in the next 6 months my trap will spring and I can buy a dog-eared copy of the, until then, unnamed manual for my library. As far as finding people goes, I've learned the net is most useful, again, for finding starting points, phone numbers to call, not for answers, but to beg suggestions about who else I should ask about my problems and questions. I've managed to build a wide-reaching network of people more experienced than I, from whom I learn, to whom I return with more hard problems, and who call me when their difficulties are ones I can help solve. Even when we're searching for news and clippings to help understand our industry, to see our competitors' new products, or just to understand trends, we're often confronted with bald statements of fact without the underlying logic and subtlety of reasoned judgment we need to understand what we're reading. Again, more phone calls, more discussion, more real-world conversation. I hope more thoughtfulness than amazement comes across as I write this. I've had the chance to experience an interesting shift from net space back to real space, one taking me back to thoughts of working for my dad as a potter, with no electronics, no wires, and no flashing light, but plenty of conversation and physical trial and error. I hadn't realized how much I missed it, and it gives me an interesting foil for the frequent moments when the net still intrudes, or our complex IT systems need debugging, or a reboot is finally required. It still doesn't scale. 19. Companies can now communicate with their markets directly. If they blow it, it could be their last chance. 22. Getting a sense of humor does not mean putting some jokes on the corporate website. Rather, it requires big values, a little humility, straight talk, and a genuine point of view. 23. Companies attempting to position themselves need to take a position. Optimally, it should relate to something their market actually cares about. 25. Companies need to come down from their ivory towers and talk to the people with whom they hope to create relationships. If you suspend a bit of disbelief and skip past the arrogant tone, there's a seductive simplicity to Clutrain. We never said it in so many words, but we strongly implied that conversation is an easy thing. Open your mouth, say something engaging in your own honest voice. If you had something interesting to say, we'd listen. Join the conversation, and judge your company to be one of the clueful ones. The details we neglected to address were manifest. I can quickly reel off a few, and I'm sure you can contribute your own. 1. How can you change a large corporate structure, one safely protected by an active PR operation, into a nimble, conversational entity with thousands of clueful ambassadors? 2. What happens to legal liability when one of your ambassadors tells the truth with repercussions? 3. Where do we find the time to listen to all the shouting and answer every yawp? 4. And so on. Tackling the problem of conversation across the internet/intranet membrane was always the one I envisioned when we talked about how to implement a Clutrain communication strategy. My current gig pushes home that point, as I have to worry about how we get the word out about our business and how we keep a customer's interest after he or she tastes our product, and how we maximize the potential for word-of-mouth connection to the next customer. However, when I look for companies succeeding at this, most of the ones I come up with are essentially small businesses with simple organizational underpinnings and a scale made manageable by an intrinsic limit on the number of company participants in the conversations. Take a peek at South African wine company Stormhook and the work they've done with Hugh MacLeod, one of my favorite food marketing examples. They're engaging, are using a bunch of media tools effectively, and have an unmistakable, comfortable style and voice. Since I'm focused on small businesses almost exclusively these days, as I started poking at the scalability of Clutrain, I asked David, Chris, and Doc for examples of larger enterprises showing signs of tackling the issues around conversational scale. The examples they suggested are, at their core, all demonstrations of how conversations might be made to work on the net. Some examples. 1. Amazon.com's ubiquitous reviews, where even our almost 10-year-old manuscript is still getting fresh comments. The site does a good job to help me become a smarter consumer of my current commodity of interest in a matter of minutes, letting me read about others' experiences with the product I want and showing me what other people, presumably ones just like me, bought after browsing the comments. 2. The Open Salon social media site, where they've created a site for people to post longish-form stories in the midst of a conversational community. Their tip-em, tip-jar concept is interesting, but the jury's still out on it. 3. Various hybrid journalism/blog sites, including Huffington Post, Slate, and others, where often the volume of reader-authored comments on a story will far exceed the length of the story itself. 4. Twitter and tweet aggregators like election.twitter.com and apps like TweetDeck, bundling and organizing Twitter's text snippets into themed or categorized streams. Looking at these, I'm struck by a basic similarity. They're all harnessing reader-generated content and reader conversations. Very little of the conversation, if any, is between the people running the enterprise and their customers. They're all providing a venue for speech and usually something to talk about, whether products, news, prose, or gossip, but the enabling company is rarely in the midst of the conversations. There may be a small number of people from the enterprise participating in the conversations, Open Salon, Slate, etc., or none at all, Amazon at least not noticeably. The insiders don't have to carry the conversations. The outsiders, you and I, do that for them. I'm not sure any of this gives me a silver bullet answer to questions about making Clutrain scale. There are some hints here. Markets with multi-sided conversations, letting me hear multiple parties, not just one, are more interesting. Having a small number of people doing the talking reduces risk and makes the task of supporting conversation more manageable. Using speech generated by a community makes your efforts more interesting to more people, with less cost to you. But I'm still unimpressed with our protestations of scalability. Maybe only a small enterprise and a small community can really do the Clutrain trick. I'm reminded of why I liked working at Sun Microsystems in the 1980s and 1990s. The company, for better or for worse, was a sometimes loosely coupled collection of entrepreneurial groups, each with its own voice and customer connections. This worked when we talked to each other or had a strong manager guiding internal coordination, or when an individual group was under the scale threshold for conversational success. Only then could we successfully navigate connecting to the world on the other side of the conversational membrane. We were a bunch of smaller companies inside a big company. Perhaps that's one of our answers to scaling. Keep it small. Conversations happen between individuals and among small groups of interested people. When the group gets too big, we break into smaller conversational circles. Collecting lots of speech gives us a matrix in which interesting conversations might happen, but without the round trip, without individuals listening to and responding to others, there isn't conversation. I get very little back when 60 people at a time taste our chocolate. I've tried. I lose most of my opportunity to connect with customers because I can only talk to a few at a time. In my business, I need to watch people's reactions, person by person, and listen. How does it taste? Obedient Poodles for God and Country by Chris Locke. If I can't hold on to you, leave me something I can hold on to. Johnny Lang, Lie to Me. It was 1966, and I was at the Monroe Grill in Rochester, New York. Headlining that night was Buddy Guy, the monster Chicago blues man, along with his sideman, Luther Snake Johnson. After the last set, Luther and I sat up till damn near dawn, talking, swapping lies, and drinking cheap whiskey. I think it was called the Monroe Grill. I was already pretty wasted when I got there, and it looks like it's too far back even for Google. Lost now in the shifting mists of time. Point is, the band was cooking that night, and the place was rocking, everybody in the groove. It was insane. Buddy had about 200 feet of cord attached to his guitar, which seemed a bit excessive, that is, until he jumped off the stage in the middle of a number, threaded his way through the crowd, and left the building. It was snowing outside that night, cold as hell. People walking down the street were seeing this crazy bastard wailing on an electric guitar that wasn't making any sound at all. Probably one of your psychotic street people, shaking their heads. Sad, really. But inside the club, the blues kept coming big time thanks to that long umbilical cord. He was totally blowing us away. And when he finally came back inside, still jamming, never missing a beat, people were yelling, cheering, jumping off tables, flipping out. That's my metaphor for the Internet 10 years ago, when we were just starting to talk about what would become the Clue Train Manifesto. Business rushing by on its way to the next interminable meeting, looking askance at some crazy street act, while we, audience to each other as I wrote back then, were safe and warm inside a very different, if virtual, world, having the time of our lives. At least it seemed safe, like a safe bet anyway, that things were really going to change this time. How could they not, with all these hooked-up barbarians straining at the gates? Then the Internet bubble burst. Well, hey, no surprise there. Hadn't we been saying that everything business was doing on the net was nuts? And then, a year and a half after Clue Train appeared as a book, those planes plowed into the World Trade Center. As it transpired, the world was not so flat as some had dreamed in the opium dens of gung-ho globalization. Whoops. It seemed we'd forgotten there was a real world out there, beyond the insular navel-gazing of Silicon Valley and the Washington Beltway. Between the bubble and the towers, business cooled considerably in its fanatical whoring after e-commerce billions. All of a sudden, the net was anathema. Pretty much nobody outside the net itself wanted to write about it. Business didn't want to hear about it. I wrote a book called Gonzo Marketing, Winning Through Worst Practices, that came out a month after 9/11. But nobody wanted to read much of anything in those dark days that wasn't about anthrax or data security. I was bummed. To quote from Repo Man, I blame society. Jacques. Duke. The lights are growing dim, Otto. I know a life of crime has led me to this sorry fate, and yet I blame society. Society made me what I am. Otto. That's bullshit. You're a white suburban punk just like me. But the net clearly hadn't disappeared or gone on vacation. Thanks to the Internet Movie Database and YouTube, which did not yet exist back then, those immortal lines are preserved for later generations, to puzzle over if nothing else. Eventually, the money came back, as it always does, having little clue where else to go. There was a new wave of venture cash for Internet startups, but this time less flamboyant, more circumspect in their approach to those market eyeballs and their metonymously groaning wallets. This time, there was a greater focus on what Wall Street wanted to hear more of, that magic mantra, monetization. At the same time, with no apparent cognitive dissonance, there were those companies who outwardly genuflected in the vague direction of Clue Train. We get it, they wanted us to know. Uh-huh. Sure you do. And, of course, there was Web 2.0 and social networking and all manner of signs and wonders in the network firmament. Some of this stuff was real, some of it even important, I guess. But I was losing interest, which is not to fault the developers who've made all the cool tools and toys we see on the web today. Why, the buzz from Twitter alone could power Milwaukee for a solid year. My loss of interest was a personal thing. Not only was there a world out there, there was also, who knew, a world in here. The towers became a tarot card metaphor for a similarly catastrophic sequence of events in my life back then. Don't worry, I won't go into it here. Suffice it to say, my towers in rubble, I looked to other horizons. And is it any wonder? Marshall McLuhan once said that each new communications medium is always perceived, mistakenly, in terms of its predecessor. Photography as a new form of painting, film as a new form of stage theater, the internet as a new form of TV. Too right. And yet, once the new thing is seen as genuinely new, how long can we marvel at its newness? How long can we enthuse over its many splendors? When telephones were a new thing, people would comment on the device itself. "Why, I can hear you as if you were in the next room." Or, "It's for you. Hurry, it's long distance." When television was new, someone might have said, "Those guys on Dragnet sure don't look like they did on the radio." For everything that is gained, something is lost. When the interstate highway system was new, back in the days of Eisenhower, I suppose there were lots of editorials in local newspapers about how the downtown business district was being affected. But it would be quite some time before scholars started writing about the impact of the interstate highways on the culture of the United States. How, for instance, it fueled the proliferation of the Beat Generation kicked off by Kerouac in On the Road, or more prosaically, perhaps, the Mission from God taken up by the Blues Brothers. Elwood. "It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses." Jake. "Hit it." Notice that Belushi did not say, "Wow, look, they're pointing that camera at us, and thanks to this brilliant film technology, millions will see us acting like fools." Yet how many internet conversations, of which markets purportedly consist, are about the very technology enabling them? When it isn't about cats wanting cheeseburgers, that is. Come to think of it, the "I can has cheeseburger" meme, you could Google it, makes a point. Some of the funniest, wackiest, most brilliantly creative stuff on the net is, and was always, remarkable and refreshing precisely because it's not about the carrier medium. No, it's about jumping off the tables while Buddy's playing outside in the snow and the quotidian, pedestrian world passing him by out there still doesn't get why that's the most wonderful thing ever, or at least tonight. Notice that the audience did not say, "Behold, the electricity from his amplifier traveled all that way without resulting in any loss in decibels." No, the audience said, "Let's boogie." But to a large extent, we are still talking on the web about pipes and wires, about online business schemes and technical methodologies, about the tools themselves. Not that there's anything wrong with tools. You discover fire, you make a bow, you chop obsidian to make an arrowhead. Sooner or later, you have to do something with those tools. Shoot something. Eat it. Just ask Sarah Palin. Which brings me to another class of things in the larger world beyond the introverted internet, politics. Since 9/11, many of us have grown increasingly aware that the vaunted internet revolution has largely served to distract from the erosion of our liberties, the corruption of our laws and social covenants, the theft of our financial and environmental wealth, and the steady rise of a larcenous cadre of unprincipled political thugs. Not that I have strong feelings in the matter. I am writing this mere days after the election of Barack Obama. The net had a lot to do with Obama's win. It was crucial in getting out the vote, vital to the unprecedented level of fundraising. YouTube did not exist during the 2004 election campaign, but played a huge role in 2008. And the diehard pals of John and Cindy, of Mooseburger Mom and her first dude, just didn't seem to have the juice, the chops, the manic intensity of Obama's shock troops, among whom I counted myself. In 2000, when Clue Train was first published, I wasn't so political. I did get to meet Al Gore, and I asked him if he'd ever read the First Amendment. A room full of editors at the New Republic offices in Washington, D.C., took my cheekiness as an opportunity to check their manicures. No one venturing word one. Gore had been explaining to me the upside of the Communications Decency Act, which would have censored the Internet. I'll give you an inconvenient truth. Tipper. And about a billion explicit lyrics labels. I'm with Eminem on that one and what he said in White America. "Fuck you, Tipper Gore. Fuck you with the freest of speech this divided states of embarrassment will allow me to have." But he ended that song, quote, "I'm just playing, America. You know I love you," unquote. Yeah, me too. So I held my nose in 2000 and voted for Al. What a rush, 8 years later, to be able to do more than flush a protesting toilet and run, as Lawrence Ferlinghetti once wrote with reference to the guy who signed, well, would you look at that, the National Interstate and Defense Highways Act of 1956. You thought I was just rambling, didn't you, you freaking beatnik? But see, we're still on the road. On the night of November 4, watching the throng in Grant Park waiting for Obama to appear, I was at first confused. Why were the CNN cameras focusing only on the crowd? Why not turn them toward the podium? Clearly something was about to happen. All these people were cheering wildly. Then it dawned on me. They were watching the huge monitors that had been set up for the event. America was cheering itself. What a beautiful moment. Another difference from 2004. All this was on the net. I haven't had TV for 8 years, but I was able to watch, in real-time video on my laptop screen, the conventions, the debates, and the victory celebration in Chicago. Impressive, magnificent technology. The tools have gotten better, the bows bigger and stronger, the arrows so much sharper. Now to kill something, metaphorically speaking, of course. As I watched that crowd in Grant Park, it seemed Oprah was getting a lot of FaceTime with the camera. Simply put, Oprah spooks me. To explain why, I need to unpack what I did with those tools while my personal twin towers were still smoking wreckage, awaiting the psychic garbage barges to haul them off to China before anyone could forensically examine what remained of my allegorical WTC-7. Less simply put, Oprah strikes me as the outward, invisible, velvet-gloved avatar of some ethereal and ghostly iron fist. Recall our interstate highways trope, and reflect that something like the delayed cultural impact of that is happening today. Back then, we could look at 8-lane highways and imposing cloverleafs and understand very little of how they would come to change America. It would take some sort of paranormal prescience to grasp the future cultural consequences of such large developments as interstate highways and information highways as they are taking place. Today we can look at the state of the web and see only faint outlines of the culture this technology is enabling. And it's impossible to ask the interstate highway question about America without looking long and hard at religion. Even the money says, "In God we trust." When it goes that far, you know you're dealing with a deeply faith-based initiative. The phrase is from some 2001 remarks by George W. Bush, but yes, Virginia, there were evangelicals going way back, even before the Internet. Back around 2004, I started poking around in the backwaters of the 19th century. I was trying to answer a personal question. How had Boulder, Colorado, where I live, come to resemble a medieval mummer's show? The place is saturated with the irrational. As long as it's magical, mystical, or mysterious, you'll find it here. Astrology, Reiki, Tarot, Gnosticism, Shamanism, Wiccan goddess worship, Castaneda-inspired tensegrity, Jungian ally work, lucid dreaming, Ekankar, integral philosophy, promise keepers, the Jack Kerouac school of disembodied poetics, harmonic convergence, Shambhala training, the list goes on and on. The faux quantum physics movie, What the Bleep Do We Know, got its start here with funding from local software entrepreneur William Arntz, whose guru channels a 35,000-year-old Lemurian warrior named Ramtha. Jello Biafra, lead singer for the Dead Kennedys, was originally from Boulder. He once said, quote, "Boulder was a magnet for all kinds of so-called movements and escapist snake oil salesmen that would now fall under the umbrella of what they call New Age." And I thought, oh my God, this sort of apathy and putting your brain to sleep and becoming an obedient little poodle is a one-way ticket to fascism. It's how people allow themselves to be taken advantage of by aspiring dictators, unquote. Is Boulder unique in this regard? Hardly. Many suspect, I did at first, that this magical mystery tour began in the 1960s with psychedelic drugs and the Beatles visiting the Maharishi. Not even close, as it turns out. Before that, there was all manner of spooky Jungiana, including an anti-Semitism that Jung's fan club has repeatedly tried to sweep under the rug, along with the great man's words of praise for Hitler, whom he called the mouthpiece of the gods and a truly mystic medicine man. The links are to Time magazine reports of 1936 and 1939, respectively. That worked right in with Heinrich Himmler's fascination with the occult and his SS-sponsored exploration of Tibet, which, going back further still, was a belated search for what Madame Blavatsky described in her Secret Doctrine of 1888 as the Aryan Root Race. But the fascination with otherworldly weirdness goes back further than that. For instance, to the burned-over district of upstate New York, so-called not because of forest fires, but as a result of the Second Great Awakening, the revivalist religious movement that gave rise to so many cults there. The most famous of these was Mormonism, an American upstart religion that saw Native Americans as the spawn of a wicked seed and refused to ordain black priests until 1978. From the same fertile region in mid-19th century came the indigenous American hoax of spiritualism, talking to the dead by table rapping in Morse code. And earlier still, in Maine in 1838, a watchmaker named Phineas Quimby listened to a lecture by a disciple of Franz Anton Mesmer and started a quasi-religious movement that has come to be variously called mental healing, mental science, mind science, and new thought. Hard to distinguish from what we would today call New Age. America has been awash in such stuff for a very long time. Remember, I was asking interstate highway-type questions about how American culture, and by extension and export, the world's, had already changed because of something that started happening over a century ago. Remember, too, that in the age of e-commerce, export entails the Internet. To document my ruminative speculations in the course of these researches, I started a blog I called Mystic Bourgeoisie. At the top of the main page, it says, quote, "The unlikely story of how America slipped the surly bonds of Earth and came to believe in signs and portents that would make the Middle Ages blush," unquote. My hypothesizing begins roughly with Emanuel Swedenborg, 1688-1772, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, 1803-1882. Note that this is about as far from Cloutrain's focus on business and marketing as it's possible to get. Which is not to say that mystic bourgeoisie is any stranger to the tools and conversations Cloutrain championed. Without the incredible research tools provided by Google Books and Amazon, perhaps especially the collective knowledge and whacked-out opinions aggregated in millions of reviews there, without Google search more generally, without Blogger for publishing, without email for distribution, i.e. hassling my poor subscribers to actually read what I publish, and extended behind-the-scenes exchanges of tips, I get lots of them, and thoughtful feedback, in other words, without the web, this project would simply not be viable. The web allows independent scholars like myself to accomplish what was once possible only for tenured professors in large universities with herds of fawning grad students at their command and control. Plus, and it's a big plus, I don't have to be particularly politic or polite. But hold on. Mystic B is not entirely divorced from the first edition of this book. A major focus of Cloutrain was the issue of authority, as in command and control hierarchies, as in authoritarian management. Now, the thing about authority is that it always wants to capitalize itself. I don't mean with venture capital. I mean like this, authority. And it tries to achieve this by referring its natural mandate to an increasingly higher power. Pretty soon, presto, God. Swedenborg and Emerson were looking for the highest of all possible higher powers. The former was quite possibly mad. The jury is still out, though he does seem to have awakened the neighbors on more than one occasion by loudly remonstrating with various visiting demons. Emerson and his transcendental pals decided to look in a less Christian direction, the mystic East. Much of what we think we know today about Oriental religions comes from frontier Protestant misreadings of bad translations of the Hindu classics. Emerson's pantheist, nature, was the velvet glove for his notions of rugged individualism and self-reliance, the iron fist of manifest destiny. Which brings us back to Oprah in Obama's front row, and why that scares me. Oprah has been the vector for many of those signs and portents mystic bourgeoisie alludes to. One recent example is her Soul series, which began with Oprah co-teaching via the web with Eckhart Tolle, whose book, A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, she'd just chosen for her far-famed book club, and naturally, it's all online. By way of introduction, Oprah says, "Welcome to our very first live worldwide interactive event. We are here tonight breaking new ground. Nothing like this has ever been attempted before. Right now, you are all online with me from every corner on our planet." I don't know. The never-been-attempted claim could be challenged by any number of hot girls with webcams. If anything, Oprah seems more than just fashionably late to the web party. And Tolle says, It's everybody's responsibility to become aware of their conditioned mental processes, how you react in everyday situations, what kind of thoughts go through your head. It's good to not amplify the negativity that you see around you in the world by reacting to it. You mean like reading this sort of thing and reminding anyone who will listen that your rap is basically recycling the same sort of mystic orientalia that Emerson and Thoreau unleashed upon an unsuspecting Puritan New England when they weren't sowing beans and cheesing off the Harvard faculty? Or Madame Blavatsky with her Theosophy when she wasn't pontificating on the lost continent of Atlantis? Or Rudolf Steiner, founder of the Waldorf schools, with his stories about how Buddha taught the Mars men? I wish I were kidding. Or, well, you mean like that? Contra Tolle, I think it's not only good to amplify the negativity we see around us by vaguely reacting to it, but more specifically by deconstructing, dissecting, and calling it what it is. In this case, 10 pounds of shit in a 2-pound bag. Is this what we've come to as a culture? Body by Barbie? Epistemology by what the bleep? The world of spirit and the world of politics have looped back on themselves like the two ends of that mythic, excuse me, archetypal snake. The Ouroboric band encircling far more than those wagons of yore pushing west. It is from the oil of this particular snake that we get manifest destiny, which derives from the same celestial neighborhood as the invisible hand. Both represent God's holy will for Americans to be free, white, and 21, roughly speaking, or at least filthy rich. In brief, manifest destiny is the uniquely American impulse to ingest every possible scrap of other people's sovereign territory in a God-frenzied desire for self-aggrandizement. This is sometimes also referred to as the law of attraction or colonialism. Much later, this colonial impulse will gather to itself other appellations: globalization, the global economy, global marketing, global e-commerce, the global internet. Manifest destiny was big in the 19th century. For some weird reason, probably Indians who haven't yet set up casinos, politicians don't like to talk about it so much these days, but it was especially popular back at the time of the Louisiana Purchase, a.k.a. the French and Indian War, the Gadsden Purchase, a.k.a. the Mexican-American War, the Oregon Treaty, a.k.a. the 54-40 or Fight War, and the Southern Accommodation, a.k.a. the Civil War. As you can see, war is a main ingredient of manifest destination. But a funny thing happened when this basic instinct hit the Pacific Ocean. No amount of dissonance manifesting seemed to have any effect on the water, which resisted the predations of all but stoned hipsters on surfboards, until, that is, in the magic 1960s, Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, Michael Murphy et al. Had a breakthrough vision of the American future. Why not go vertical and colonize the mind? Thus was Esalen Institute born, hard by the ancient Indian hot tubs and vast marijuana plantations of Big Sur. Fritz Perls served as the resident model for R. Crumb's Mr. Natural, while Abraham Maslow disguised his long-standing fascination with dominance by rebranding it as self-esteem. And just about anybody who was everybody, Goo Goo Gajoob, was there then. As P.T. Barnum said, there's one born every minute. Man, what a market! Conversations optional. If politicians don't like to talk about manifest destiny, spiritual, but heavens not religious, types show no such reservations. Exhibit A would have to be Wayne Dyer's best-selling Manifest Your Destiny, The 9 Spiritual Principles for Getting Everything You Want. Dyer is in a long line of American New Thought practitioners, a line that included Mary Baker Eddy and her Christian Science. Sci-fi writer L. Ron Hubbard had lots of inspiration for Scientology. Dyer's general thrust in Manifest Your Destiny is that you can be what you want to be, on Cloud 9. This is sometimes also referred to as the law of attraction or wishful thinking. When invoked by affluent whites, i.e. not the Temptations, who were talking about heroin addiction, it is often a symptom of aggravated spiritual greed syndrome. Well, so what? What's all this? Repo Men, Beat Poets, Interstate Highways, Ike, Oprah, Eminem, Alan Tipper, Moose Burgers, Poodles, Manifest Destiny, and What the Bleepers got to do with anything? Skipping over the fact that the world is slated to end in 2012 when the Mayan calendar's Energizer Bunny runs down, let me give you an example a bit closer to home. In the run-up to the election, among the many places I looked for clues as to Obama's chances, I visited Gallup.com, the online arm of an outfit that dates back to 1935. Wikipedia tells us, quote, to ensure his independence and objectivity, Dr. Gallup resolved that he would undertake no polling that was paid for or sponsored in any way by special interest groups, a commitment that Gallup upholds to this day. Independent and objective. Sounds solid, right? Trustworthy. Then imagine my surprise on discovering that Deepak Chopra, the best-selling author of such titles as The Seven Spiritual Laws of Success and Quantum Healing, is a senior scientist with the company. This is an organization, keep in mind, whose reports on the leanings of the American electorate substantially shape the output of mainstream media. Why is he involved at all? His Gallup bio says, Dr. Chopra is the world's leading living authority on connectedness. Connectedness? WTF? I rabbit off to Google and search it up. At his publisher's site, Random House, I find a passage from Chopra's book, The Spontaneous Fulfillment of Desire, Harnessing the Infinite Power of Coincidence to Create Miracles. Miracles. I see. I also see that connectedness is a subset of something he calls synchrodestiny. I wonder whether synchro is a secret handshake sort of synonym for manifest, but I read on. It seems that synchrodestiny, quote, allows us to see meaning in the world, to understand the connectedness or synchronicity of all things, to choose the kind of life we want to live, and to fulfill our spiritual journey, unquote. This is science? By whose definition is this even remotely proximate to the scientific ballpark? The equation of connectedness with synchronicity provides a clue. The latter is a concept developed by the psychologist Carl Jung, who had a lifelong love affair with the paranormal and all things esoteric and occult, and Wolfgang Pauli. While Pauli was a bona fide quantum physicist, the concept of synchronicity was based on Jung's analysis of his dreams. It is not accepted as part of the scientific canon. We are dealing here with a form of high-flown obfuscatory mysticism, not any sort of grounded rational analysis. But who can tell anymore? This kind of spiritualized self-help jargon masquerading as independent and objective thought has invaded every shelf in the major bookstores, online and off, from science to psychology, from medicine to business. In the case of business books and websites by the million, much of this New Age blatherskite is sneaked in, Trojan horse style, in the form of life coaching or various wrinkles on so-called positive psychology. Abraham Maslow is something of a father figure to both. His management concepts are collected in the Maslow Business Reader, and his hierarchy of needs is often cited in the literature of business management. Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow, is a more recent hagiography. But few know the Maslow who wrote in his 1987 book, Motivation and Personality, quote, the study of crippled, stunted, immature, and unhealthy specimens can yield only a cripple psychology and a cripple philosophy, unquote. Specimens? That's an uncomfortably harsh repudiation of the mentally ill, but it should come as no big revelation. Maslow's primary mentor was Edward L. Thorndike, a prominent interwar advocate of eugenics. And it was to American eugenics that Nazi Germany looked for inspiration in the development of the Final Solution, an extermination project that began not with Jews or gypsies, but with patients in mental hospitals. Let's hope it was a peak experience for them. If Maslow is counted as an inspiration for positive psychology, a course on which is the most highly attended class at Harvard these days, then Martin Seligman is its reigning monarch. His pop psych book, Authentic Happiness, Using the New Positive Psychology to Realize Your Potential for Lasting Fulfillment, 2002, is based on his earlier work documented in Learned Helplessness, A Theory for the Age of Personal Control, 1993. Hold that thought. Control. The central insight of the latter book derived from delivering painful electrical shocks to dogs until they no longer attempted to even resist this, well, let's call it what it was, torture. Unsurprisingly, it was on the basis of this learned helplessness research that the CIA invited Seligman to consult on techniques that ended up being used on human prisoners at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. This is well documented by Jane Mayer in her 2008 book, The Dark Side, The Inside Story of How the War on Terror Turned into a War on American Ideals. She also discussed Seligman's involvement in a follow-up interview for Harper's. Yet business can't seem to get enough of the guy. For one of many instances, see Pepperdine University's MBA course, the positive psychology approach to goal management. It is also noteworthy that his work has been strongly supported by the Templeton Foundation, which even offers a Martin E. P. Seligman Award. The Foundation's homepage banner reads, quote, "Supporting Science, Investing in the Big Issues," unquote. For Templeton, the big issues clearly trend toward the transcendent. Among its core themes, we find a prayer and meditation project which, quote, "supports research to advance objective scientific understanding of prayer and meditation," unquote. And Templeton has the bucks to enlist many credentialed academics into such objective scientific studies. Its annual Templeton Prize is larger than the Nobel. Are we dealing with cutting-edge science here, with a new form of esoteric religion, or with some hybrid brand of cognitive snake oil whose origins date back to the 19th century? My money is on the last option. Proving these connections to a fare-thee-well is beyond the scope of this chapter. I've always wanted to write that. But various aspects of the theme are greatly expanded on my Mystic Bourgeoisie blog, to which the reader is kindly referred. I've always wanted to write that, too. Meanwhile, whether it's America's long fascination with higher power, from Jonathan Edwards to A.A., Maslow's preoccupation with dominance as self-esteem, Seligman's come-hither cajolery re-personal control, or the imposed corporate culture of command and control we wrote about in the Clutrain Manifesto, if anything can be said to be counter-Clutrain, it is an infatuation with authority. In Chapter 1 of the book, I wrote, quote, "The Internet is inherently seditious. It undermines unthinking respect for centralized authority, whether that authority is the neatly homogenized voice of broadcast advertising or the smarmy rhetoric of the corporate annual report," unquote. Ironically, authority seems to be making a comeback, using the very medium we naively thought might defeat it. How to explain this? I got valuable answers to this question from John Dean. If you were around for Watergate, yeah, that John Dean. His Conservatives Without Conscience, 2006, unpacks psychologist Robert Altmaier's groundbreaking research on authoritarianism. Thanks to Dean popularizing his work, Altmaier has put the full text of his most recent book, The Authoritarians, on the web. Most of us think of authoritarians as despots and dictators, but Altmaier says that the more common type is what he calls the authoritarian follower. By their numbers and degree of willing submission, it is these followers who create the seductive opportunity for authoritarian leaders. It's a symbiotic, if twisted, relationship. Here's Altmaier in his own words, quote, "Authoritarian followers usually support the established authorities in their society, such as government officials and traditional religious leaders. Such people have historically been the proper authorities in life, the time-honored, entitled, customary leaders, and that means a lot to most authoritarians. Psychologically, these followers have personalities featuring, 1, a high degree of submission to the established, legitimate authorities in their society, 2, high levels of aggression in the name of their authorities, and 3, a high level of conventionalism," unquote. Thank God we put business as usual behind us, eh? What has changed, I would offer, in the formula above, are the traditional and time-honored bits. Our culture has succeeded virtually overnight in elevating utter non-entities to the status of authority figures, those famous for being famous, those powerful by dint of usurping power, those seen as wise because they're wealthy, those revered as numinous for channeling the Easter Bunny. If I were blogging this, I could show you, in graphic detail, as they say, some killer examples of the true believers and jive-ass jingoists to whom Altmaier's criteria apply. But this isn't a blog, and lawyers are so expensive. Maybe another time. For now, 10 years after Clutrain, I think I need to reach back much further for a closing argument. Here it is. Don't follow leaders. Watch your parking meters. Bob Dylan, Subterranean Homesick Blues, 1965. In Defense of Optimism by David Weinberger. Oh, we were feeling our oats in 1999. The Internet was a primal force, a hurricane aimed straight at the mightiest institutions in the world. It was going to sweep them away while, quite unhurricane-like, giving us the tools to refashion what those institutions had gotten so wrong. The Internet was letting us get it right, attacking the inhuman alienation characteristic of institutions driven from the top. Every layer of management, every calculated message delivered to the mass market,